Welcome to A Better Future for All in conversation with Kerry O'Brien, presented by Griffith University and HODA, Home of the Arts, on the Gold Coast.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. My name is Carolyn Evans. I'm the Vice Chancellor and President of Griffith University, and it's my great pleasure, on behalf of the University and HODA, the Home of the Arts here on the beautiful Gold Coast, to welcome you here this evening. HODA and Griffith proudly acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we meet tonight, the Kumamerri families of the Yugambeh language region. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and recognise their continuing connection to the land, waters and their extended communities throughout southeast Queensland. We have many special guests with us tonight, but I'd like to particularly acknowledge His Worship, the Mayor, Councillor Tom Tate and Mayoress Ruth Tate, councillors of the City of Gold Coast, William Owen Jones and Donna Gates, Ms Corinna Gurkha, CEO of the Home of the Arts, and of course we'll come later to the people who are on the stage who are the reason that so many of us are here tonight. Could I also welcome members of the Griffith Council and Executive, the HOTA Board, and our industry partners. Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome you all here for the first of the season, A Better Future for All 2022. We're back for another season of Insight here at HOTA. In its first year, the Better Future for All season saw renowned journalist Kerry O'Brien sit down with some wonderful, exciting, bright minds from around Australia and indeed around the globe, including academics, activists, authors, diplomats, politicians and more. Together they explore topics ranging from the most personal of struggles to the biggest challenges facing our world today. Well, we're delighted to welcome Kerry back to the big chair for another round of his signature conversations, canvassing the ideas and actions that will shape our world as we begin to explore the challenges and opportunities in what I think we all sincerely hope is a post-pandemic future. For 2022's first foray, we'll hear the compelling, heart-swelling story of the celebrated dancers Lee Soo-shin and Mary Lee, of their very different early lives, their success on the stage, and their enduring love, sparked by a chance meeting in London more than 30 years ago. With their dancing days now behind them, and having served respectively as the artistic director and the ballet mistress of the Queensland Ballet for almost a decade, Lee and Mary have become one of the state's premier cultural power couples. They are also both accomplished authors. Lee's autobiography, Mao's Last Dancer, earned best-selling status on its release in 2003, eventually being adapted into an Actor Award winning film in 2009. Mary's own more recent memoir, Mary's Last Dance, has also achieved acclaim since its release in 2020, winning the Courier Mail's People's Choice Queensland Book of the Year in 2021. Under Lee and Mary's stewardship, the Queensland Ballet has blossomed. It has become the state's and indeed one of the nation's premier dance companies, not only through its wonderful and truly extraordinary dancing history, and I do hope many of you are going to stay on tonight to see tonight's performance as evidence of that, but also because of its role in the community. It hosts a wealth of workshops, events, professional development and training opportunities, health initiatives, regional programs, youth programs and more. Tonight, I'm very proud to announce that Griffith will be adding to the ballet's storied history and community engagement with a three-year partnership centred on a range of internship opportunities, research collaborations and training initiatives. Our academics will be working with the ballet on a range of health education and research programs, in addition to delivering a suite of micro-credentials to help the ballet's dancers and staff develop their own skill sets. The partnership builds on a long relationship that Griffith has with Queensland Ballet. One such previous collaboration, for example, delivered a ballet program for people living with brain injury with extraordinary results. It was developed in partnership with the Hopkins Centre and the Griffith Creative Arts Research Institute. We're really excited about this partnership and its potential for positive change, the better future, indeed, that we hope it will create. For tonight now, we're very happy to launch this partnership by asking you to settle in for the wonderful people who have made the magic happen, Lee and Mary, in conversation with Kerry O'Brien.
Mary Lee Shwin Sing, welcome. Lee, I want to take you back at the start of our conversation, nearly 40 years, to 18 December 1984. It was the opening night of the Nutcrack in Houston with a sellout crowd. You were the principal dancer. You hadn't seen your parents since you'd defected 6 years before. Finally, Chinese authorities had allowed them to visit you in America, and they were being rushed from Houston Airport, just in time for the opening curtain. So these two ageing peasants who had seen had a very limited view of the world, who'd barely travelled beyond their village in Shandong province before flying to America, were given a standing ovation as they walked into the theatre in their best Mao jackets. I hope this is all coming back to you. They saw you dance for the first time in your career that night. So there's an awful lot going on at your end and at theirs. They absorbed your own thundering ovation for a brilliant performance. And after all that ecstatic, once-in-a-lifetime experience, they joined you backstage. What were your father's first words to you?
He said to me, when he got closer and closer with a puzzled expression on his face, he said to me, "Why didn't you wear any pants?"
And you said?
Well, as you said, my parents as peasants never left their hometown before, never went in a car, on a train, on an airplane before, never seen their son dance before, never went to a theater before. So for them, seeing somebody wearing a pair of ties is all very strange.
But particularly their son.
Yeah, but I remembered that night, I was so emotional. I felt like a bird. So free. I never felt like that kind of freedom in my life, because for those 6 dark years, I thought I would never see them again. So suddenly they were there in that performance. I was only told that my parents were in the audience virtually just before the curtain went up. They delayed the performance, waited for them because their plane was delayed. We were told that there's some VIPs coming to the performance. We assume it was Vice President Bush or Barbara Bush, because they came to the performance quite often, and she was on the board of the Houston Ballet at the time, but happened to be my parents. So you can imagine just how I felt. Hardly could contain myself, keep the tears back.
So for another person, that could have had the opposite effect. They could have become a bundle of nerves. But you're saying that it was like the performance of your life.
It was. I could have easily swung the other way. I could have been total emotional mess, which I was actually, but I managed to control it. It became such a powerful thing for me that night.
I want to draw a comparison between the way each of you was introduced to ballet as young children. Mary, you were 8 when you experienced your first ballet class, the third child in a middle-class family living in Rockhampton, in central Queensland on the coast, with a mother steeped in music, dance and art. You found yourself in ballet because a nun called Sister Zita told your mother, "Mary sounds like an elephant on the piano, but dances like a fairy." So describe that first ballet class, and particularly how you felt as you left.
You missed out the nappies with Coralie as well. Dance, ballet and nappies, because she had 8 children. I was just very lucky. I happened upon it by accident, really, through Sister Zita, who'd gone to school with my mother, and also a friend that said, you know, would I like to go to ballet on a Saturday morning with a friend of mine. And my mother said, "Oh, delighted, please take her." And I went in, and all the little girls were in white dresses and little pink sashes, and they looked really tiny, and I was an 8-year-old in a black leotard, and my mother had bought me the wrong shoes. She always got everything wrong with the ballet. But I just, I took to the music and the dance from day one, and springing into the air. And this friend of mine that went with me, she said that teacher took to me immediately as well. So there was some sort of simpatico there. And from that moment, it's the only place I wanted to be. And that's continued on for the rest of my life, really.
So first time you're exposed to it, you walk out of that studio and you're walking on air, basically.
Yeah.
And that's your life. Now, Lee, in contrast, you were 11. You'd been plucked from your village school by 4 Beijing officials to audition for Madame Mao's new ballet academy, because you had long toes and didn't cry out in pain when you copped a forceful knee in your back to check your hip joints. Describe your Beijing audition.
That was quite brutal. I was 10, just about turning 11, and they went through millions of kids across China selecting the best bodies. I didn't know I had the best bodies, body at the time. I was a peasant boy. We worked in the fields, all that. But I remember that first day, we walk into this mud coming shack, which is our classroom. It was so freezingly cold outside, the temperature in my hometown could get down to 18, 20 degrees below zero at winter time. It was one of those cold mornings and snowed everywhere. And there's no heating inside, freezing. We were wearing these thick cotton quilted cotton pants our mothers had sewn for us. We looked like these round snowballs. And we were so freezing, you know, it's just you're shaking. We're all shaking there. And then what keeps us warm was our teacher taught us to read this textbook, which is We Love You, Chairman Mao. And it says read 10 times in a row. So in the middle of that reading, four men from the Beijing Dance Academy walk into the room. They ask to stand up to sing songs, We Love You, Chairman Mao kind of songs. As we're singing, they walk along the aisles, look at each person's faces, try and get some vague idea about our physical body shape through our snowball-like clothes. And they pass me by without taking any notice. Out of the 40 kids, they selected one girl. Just as they're about taking her out the door, my class teacher stopped the last gentleman, says, excuse me, sir, what about that one? And she was pointing at me. So after... Are
you sure she was pointing at you, or was she pointing at the one next to you, and you were just quicker than they were?
No, that moment changed my life. And then we went through this most horrific audition process.
The one I want to come to is the second one, really, when you're in Beijing, and they put you through the mill, well and truly.
Yeah, we went through from 5:30 in the morning to 9 o'clock at night, 6 days a week we trained. So it was just absolutely brutal and broken a lot of hamstrings and backs and all that because the training was so harsh.
But right as they were taking each of you through and checking you physically, whether you were physically up to it,
They test you, and we were at one stage. I was pushed against the corner of the wall. One person held one knee straight. The second person pushed both my shoulders against the corner of the walls. You could not move a single inch. And a third person forced my other leg up and up, high up in the air. As he forced your leg higher and higher, he kept asking me, "Does it hurt?" And of course, it was so painful, and I kept smiling, shook my head, said, no, doesn't hurt.
Because you'd seen what had happened to some of those before you.
That's right. They were instantly dismissed because they screamed out with pain.
So Mary says as she left her first ballet class that her world had been transformed instantly and her love for dance was born. How did you feel as you left your first ballet class at Madame Mao's Beijing Ballet Academy?
I hated it with passion. I absolutely hated it. It was so awkward, it was so agony, and I felt so hopeless because I didn't get it. And I was slow, I was frustrated, and everything felt like I was being thrown into a tumbler, and it was just totally out of control. The whole Beijing experience was out of control. Because in my hometown, there's no story higher than four-level height in building in my hometown. All the streets were mud streets and everything, where I grew up, all common shacks with no running water. So going into Beijing, everything was turned upside down. I was totally lost.
Mm. So do you recommend the Beijing method or the Rockhampton method? I mean, one of the things that intrigued me in reading your book, and it was fascinating reading them, actually, one after the other, and both very compelling, it's probably one of the biggest tests your books have been put to because it was a pretty intense read, but I was gripped all the way through with both. Real kind of insights to the whole world of dance, apart from anything else, but how long was it in those crazy circumstances before you realised that you had actually come to love dancing with a passion. Can you remember a breakthrough moment?
Yes, it was in my fourth year. The end of the second year, I was nearly, I was convinced I was going to be fired. I was so hopeless. My grades were so poor. And then when we had a new ballet teacher came into my life, my ballet teacher called Teacher Xiao, he was the one who really took special interest in me. At the beginning, I simply did not want to disappoint him because he was kind to me. He took a special interest in me. And then gradually I worked a little bit harder. And then by the fourth year, I suddenly realized by putting those extra little effort in, I was improving. And the sensation of staying in the air when you leaped, feeling the wind, and you pass the wind through when you traveled, carve the space when you leap, you know, charging into the air, it was accelerating. It just physically feels so good. And then once I start feeling that kind of sensation I've never felt physically before, and I loved it. And then when you combine it with the music, as Mary said, eventually I combine the two. And then I thought I would rather do this than anything else in my life. Mm. It was enjoyable. It was beautiful.
And how for how many other kids who'd gone through that process with you did that actually happen? That out of that strange way of picking potential dancers, the dancer emerges. How true was it for all the others of that
not
era?
Not a huge amount.
No, not many.
No.
In those two years we had, 2 years in a row, my year was only 44. And the next year was slightly larger, around 60. Out of over 100 kids, which was the best little bodies you can choose. At the time, we had probably about two or three of the international standard dancers emerged. Mm. And, you know, it's very, very rare. Yeah. They were the most elite, you know, physicality across China out of millions of kids. Mm.
Mary, 8 years after your first ballet class, at the tender age of 16, you were at the Royal Ballet School in London. And your pathway was progressively upwards from there for the next 20 years. How do you measure the cost of the intensely single-minded effort that you had to make to break into the competitive world of ballet and then to reach the top and stay there?
Gosh, I think, well, first of all, my teacher suggesting that I go to London was a miracle anyway. And then she just knew that I had talent and that as long as I got to see what was out there, I would be able to get there because I was an extraordinarily hard worker. And all of seeing things around me and theatre and all of it inspired. And luckily for me, my parents, who knew nothing about ballet, were happy to send me to London, whether it worked or not. And then once I got there, I'm not sure if it was just an extraordinary period in the 70s. Like the two, my teachers were principal dancers from the Royal Ballet. We could go upstairs, watch Angela Sibley and Anthony Dowell and Kenneth McMillan. We'd go to Covent Garden to see all the... So for me, it was like, I've arrived and I want to be part of this and how can I get there? And it was very competitive, but I think I was just very single-minded. And by luck, you know, Rudolf Nureyev was creating a... his first Romeo and Juliet, and they needed more dancers. And I didn't audition, I didn't get in, but the ballet mistress had seen me and called me up and said, Rudolf wants to look at more dancers, would you come in? And I went into the studio at Don Maher in Covent Garden. It was just one studio for London Festival Ballet, and I saw this man in the fur coat and the big hat and the boots walk across the studio, because no, I had no idea they were doing a Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
And he did class, so I tried to be inconspicuous, and I had a week with class, and at the end of that week, I got a job, which was just amazing. And so Rudolf was there, and I thought, well, everybody gets into a company with Rudolf Nureyev. So the standard was like that. And so, but I thought that was normal because I didn't know anything else. Yeah. And so it was an extraordinary lucky time. And he was around with us for 10 years with other inspiring people and took us all over the world. And he worked like a demon. So did we.
So I've got nothing against Rocky because my father was born there. But it's a big step from your first class at 8 in Rockhampton to just that few years later, you're in London, one of the most sophisticated cities in the world, surrounded by the stars of ballet. That must have been an extraordinary kind of transition for you.
Extraordinary, but it's the only place that I wanted to be was in the ballet and theatre, and I did my first performance at Covent Garden as part of the school show, and then we performed all over the world. And really, it was all day, every day. There was no time for anything else. You did your washing on Sunday and the rest of the week you just worked and had very little money to do anything else and very little time. And we were taken all over the world. The education was incredible. Yeah. And then it wasn't like, and you could see, you know, step by step, if I just did this or if I just did that, I just did that. So it was a very, even though it was fast, it was still sort of a steady journey.
But there was still obviously, and I'll ask you this too, Lee, there were still obviously very important moments of inspiration, not just along your broader path, but within particular productions that would lead you to grow.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where you would, pardon the pun, take the extra step.
Yeah, yeah.
And Lee, I mean, I know you described this in your book in particular moments where someone, whether you'd find it in yourself or someone would help you find it.
Yes. Is watching performances like Baryshnikov's performance in New York City or work with legendary choreographers such as Kenneth MacMillan or being coached by some famous teachers and all that. Those are the breakthrough moments. And those are the moments you mature, you learn, you discover something new. But I think as artists, it's really about being open-minded. Doesn't matter how good you are. Doesn't matter where you are. I mean, the early years, everything shocked me, just absolutely. Even walking to a grocery store in Houston when I first got there was a shock. So then going to New York, going to the Metropolitan Opera House, seeing a performance with Baryshnikov and Nureyev on stage at the same time, you're thinking, my God, this is just amazing. So I can't go to sleep at night afterwards, so excited. And those are the moments that propel your careers. But it's really when you are open-minded as an artist, you can almost learn from anybody. So even I feel when I walk into a studio rehearsing, I might be the principal role, but when I walk with other dancers, often I actually learn from them as well. Mm. And working, being rehearsed, coached by people like Margot Fonteyn, both of us being there with her, you're just thinking, you know, really at the time you take things really for granted. Only afterwards, when all that's over, you're really reflecting on it. You're thinking, this is the most special moment in my life, in our careers.
So once you had reached the top, in the sense that you were principal dancers in great companies, how did you benchmark yourself against the best, against a Baryshnikov, against a Nureyev, against a Fonteyn?
I personally never did, so and I don't think
I didn't think I benchmarked them.
Benchmark myself against
them. But I was always I used them as my source of motivation more than anything. Yeah. And I want to dance as brilliantly as them, jump as high as them, and those are things. Really, it's very difficult, actually. It's very difficult to benchmark yourself in ballet.
And it's all about also, you know, being given the role. So I did my first Swan Lake at 23 on a Saturday night, and that was an amazing achievement and just the beginning of the journey. So I think you benchmark yourself with certain roles, and Giselle and then Romeo and Juliet, and I did Sleeping Beauty with Lee and Giselle with Lee, and then you're never good singly. You're only good with a partner. Mm. So if the both of you, and you don't always like a marriage, you know, not you can't marry everyone. And so, you know, so if so,
some people have
when Lee and I danced together, we didn't need to explain, because it just was special. So when that partnership happens, then you get elevated to another level. And we tried not to get married because our partnership was so good. Because, you know, it has to be height, it has to be maturity, it has to be musicality, it has to be work ethic, it has to be direction, focus, all of those things. If one of those things is not working, you cannot make the art.
And chemistry.
And chemistry. There, that one as well.
So, obviously, in the creative world, in the arts, there are many. I imagine each form of art has its own syndrome of, in the case of writer's block. Did you ever have any moments of crisis like that where you suddenly felt, this is it, I can't develop this any further? Or
I think there's lots of down moments and definitely disappointments where you thought you would be given a role and then you weren't given a role, or, you know, someone else was given that and you thought, oh, that would be me, or, yeah, so... And those moments you had to, like, suck it up and go, well, you know, they didn't like me, so... But those are the moments where you had to continue to work and not let that... You know, you could have your own hurt or disappointment, but you weren't allowed to show that at all.
So. Yes. It's really the, you go through a period of times, yeah. And it seems like it doesn't matter how hard you try, nothing happens. You're not making progress, you're not getting the roles you think you should be getting. So you...
And you'd have a sense of the clock ticking.
Oh, absolutely, because yeah. A dancer's career is so short. And so those are the moments you have to find a way to keep your positive mindset. That positivity is so crucial and important. And for me, I guess coming from such a poor background, you had to always keep that positive mindset and to keep your hopes alive. Otherwise, we would all end up killing ourselves as a child, you know, going through that kind of life. So my parents told us that very clearly. You always see the sunny side of life. Mm. So as a dancer, when we go through these kind of dark moments, I always go back to remember where I had to come from.
And the frog.
And the frog
at the bottom
of
the deep well.
That's right.
Yes. And in the context of that too, I mean, you both write of your capacity to dance through injuries that would stop a footballer in some cases. I think it was you, Lee, you danced through with a dislocated shoulder and I don't know how often.
Herniated discs.
Yeah, herniated discs.
And herniated discs.
Yeah, that's right.
And various hamstrings.
Not too many, but bad hip, yeah.
But I think with the herniated discs or with the dislocated shoulder, you continued to dance and continued to
Yeah. Giselle, with me.
No, actually, I think...
That was the herniated disc.
That was my herniated disc.
I had to roll you over.
But my dislocated shoulder was right. Carry your right. That was when I first got there. Yeah. I got this rare opportunity to dance this very, brilliant pas de deux called La Corsaire pas de deux, which is a Bravura pas de deux. And then I was dancing with a ballerina in the company. I was a exchange student. And we have this flip and catch her in one hand. And on the way up, and she wasn't quite in position, and she tried to adjust it mid-air. That was a no-no. And then my shoulder just totally dislocated in the middle. So I catch her down with the other arm, and then basically was in such pain. But I didn't want to lose that opportunity, and because that's a dream role to do. So I danced through that whole period.
So it really was good training back in Beijing.
if there's nothing the Beijing does can be taught us, which is actually a lot, but is that toughness, is that resilience. Because that training, if you survive that training for 7 years, really throughout my career, nothing fazed me really, because that 7 years was so brutal.
But you were a commodity to them, I go, but I won't dwell on this, but you were a commodity to them. And I suppose if you didn't make it, there'd be somebody else. But to go through that process in the name of art is extraordinary, really. But then yes. To emerge beyond that and be a part of creating something absolutely profoundly beautiful.
You have to love it. You got to love it, and which we both, for us, we're lucky to find the love and passion for ballet. And once you love it, you can put up with anything almost.
So how do you know when you've reached the limits of your potential?
You never do, because there's so much to learn just in theatre. I mean, physically in dance, but as artists, both now working on the other side, our potential has increased immeasurably. I mean, I've learned more about the roles teaching to our dancers now, so the potential for growth is just enormous. So ballet doesn't just end on the stage, actually. Well, we're both going on the stage again, actually.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I think once you feel you have reached your potential, that's the moment you actually stop getting better. I really think, as I said earlier, as artists, it's all about keep your mind open. And once you keep your mind open, you can continue to learn. And when I came here, I was already 35. For most dancers, they would have retired, well retired by then. I danced my final 3.5 years with the Australian Ballet. I swear that was the best 3.5 years of my career.
Now, if you could narrow it down to what was it that made that the best 3.5 years of it? Was it the accumulated sum of the knowledge and the fact that your body was still together and you were able to meet the physical challenges?
Yeah.
It was the combination of all of those
things? Yeah, experience, maturity, and also, actually, Mary has a lot to do with that, to encourage me to be as true to myself, to believe in myself as much as possible. Because for many years when I danced, I want to be Baryshnikov, I want to be Nureyev, so a lot of the roles they were famous for, I want to measure myself up to that, I want to be
That's what I was talking about. Okay. Benchmark.
You got your answer then. but I never really were very happy, because they were not mine. Mm. They are not my interpretation. So only towards the end of my career, I thought I don't have that much time left. If I don't start doing that now, I would forever regret it. So I try to then become truthful and to be honest with my dancing. And that's when I really went to another level.
Wow. I know that choreographers are a very important part of the process for you both. I want you to tell me how that works. Is it a collaboration?
Yes, but they push you to a limit that you don't think you're going to get there. And so they really find things in you that you don't think is possible. Like, we work with this wonderful man called Glenn Tetley, both of us, and his work was so difficult. And he just pulled it out of you. So it's great choreographers, you know, make you do things that you just couldn't imagine that you were going to do. And then you arrive somewhere and you think, wow.
How did I get there?
Yeah, there
couldn't have done it by yourself.
Yeah, there are generally two types of choreographers. Yeah. One type is dictators. They really do. They just want you to do what the choreography is. Yeah. Nothing more, nothing less. And the other type is that more collaborative. And they will give you a theme, even contemporary choreographers, particularly these days, they give you a theme. They said, all right, I want you to turn in circles this way for 8 counts. And then I want you to create movements, turn 8 counts the other way. So you can use your body, you can use your head, you can use your shoulders, and etc. You can do pirouettes, whatever. So within those 8 counts. So that's, you know, that's the other type of working collaboratively. So in my career, I've worked with both, and I enjoyed both, but more so with the second type. Is a bit more of, you know, true collaborative spirit. The first type is basically really trying to interpret the best way possible for that choreography.
I want to talk about the pursuit of perfection. I wonder to what extent that's a blessing and to what extent a burden, because I'm not sure how often it's possible to achieve perfection in life's pursuits, or whether it's ever really attainable. And if you really are a perfectionist, surely there's a risk that you're going to be doomed to disappointment in the end, or worse, go mad.
Yeah, I think I'm a ferocious perfectionist, and I, after writing the book, often I thought, why was I so hard on myself? Why didn't I think, you know, I was better than I was? So often to my dancers now, I go, no, you are beautiful. And I tell them, because they automatically, when you get to that level, you are a perfectionist.
Is there fear of failure in there anywhere?
Not really failure, just not being the best ever. Mm. And so that will be going through my Aurora tonight. And so I've just said to her, you're so beautiful. You're going to be... And people didn't really... Because that wasn't that kind of generation then.
Just very quickly tell me about Aurora tonight.
The Aurora is a beautiful young girl that Lee found in a competition when she was 18. And she didn't win the prize, but she made him cry. So he came back and said, I've offered her a young artist position. And she's been with us for the whole 10 years.
10 years.
And so she's our Aurora tonight, and she's going to be, you know, amazing and wonderful. And she's a perfectionist, and she works every day to a level like, and that's why she's there, and she has had our guidance as well, so very special.
I have a slight different take on perfection. I felt if it wasn't for the pursuit of that perfection, I would never have been where I was as a dancer. The level, I would never have attained the level I achieved. So I felt instinctively, perhaps because I came from such a harsh life, so when I have the opportunities, I want to maximize that opportunity. So for me, life's too short. If you're going to do something, you might as well to do it to the utmost perfection, if you can, if you ever can. But being said that, you can sometimes be too harsh and not be able to enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
So a part of it would be an immense and intense discipline.
Yeah.
But the other part would be trying to free yourself.
Yeah.
And I said we had a rehearsal this afternoon, dress rehearsal, with our tomorrow matinee cast, this beautiful dancer called Mia Heathcote, very quietly, I don't want her to hear this, and she did Aurora. And then something went a little bit wrong during the wedding pas de deux, which is an iconic pas de deux. And both of them started cracking up, laughing, because it's a rehearsal, not a performance. But their mood instantly lit up, as though this sort of really worrying dark cloud suddenly lifted. I went to them, I said afterwards, I said, I don't want that mistake happening, but that's the mood I want in the performance. I want you to be able to laugh, because when you do it, you lift my spirit up. That will happen to the audience. So things like that, and that perfection probably weighed them down. But something funny, some mistake, triggered the best out of them.
It's a fine line.
So when there's a lot of stories around that. I'm going to, well, before I change the pace a little bit, because I want to talk about you and Sophie, well, all of you and Sophie.
Yeah.
But how long would a season be for a ballet company? How long would you find yourself dancing virtually non-stop before you'd pause briefly and then move on to your next?
We normally, for a typical program, we rehearse, we learn from the beginning of the choreography to performance. Normally it takes about 4 to 6 weeks. And then we perform for about 2 to 3 weeks. Within the 2 to 3 weeks, we do anywhere between 10 to 16 performances. Mm. So then they basically, after the performance, they go back to another 4 to 6 weeks rehearsal, yeah, another 2 to 3 weeks of performances. Mm. And then once we add the tours there, you can just add up the number of performances. So our company does over 100 performances a year.
Mm. So it must be a hell of a process to actually to sustain your level of performance, to actually to stay in the zone, if you like, and to deal with all that endless adrenaline. You'd get through a performance, you'd come down backstage, you'd try and sleep, and then you'd be back the next day, the next night, and on and on and on. I mean, that must take its own toll.
It does, but I think that's one of the beautiful things about a ballet company. You're surrounded by your friends and your colleagues, and so we get them through, but then that backstage, that unique place where they share and they want you, like all the dancers will be wanting the Aurora to do well tonight, because that will reflect on them. So I think, and once they start performing, they get the adrenaline and they've done one show and they can't wait to do the next. So it's a tough
schedule for the dancers physically, yeah, mentally, and it needs huge resilience and you have to be so determined to be a dancer, but they live to dance, they live to perform, so they would rather be too exhausted than not exhausted enough.
Yeah. Mm. That's right, they prefer to be overworked than underworked.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Mary, when you were confronted by the news that your 18-month-old daughter Sophie was profoundly deaf, and you forced yourself to make that crucial decision to put your daughter first and end your dancing career, not try to maintain the two, how many more years do you think you had as a principal dancer at that point?
4 or 5.
Right.
Yeah, at the top.
So a big, tough decision. Because it came on you quite suddenly.
I was in my prime, yeah, definitely, definitely. But I, it was so shocking. I'd never met a profoundly deaf child, neither had Lee. So, and I realised I just couldn't imagine a life not being able to communicate with my daughter, and I knew that even at 18 months that time would be running out. So,
In other words, if you didn't switch your focus from that time, every day would be a lost day.
And there was an amazing therapist, actually. She had that we went to see, sat in a circle, and I said, I'm a ballerina and I've got to go. And she just looked at me across the room as if, well, if you want your daughter to speak, you're going to have to be the one. Mm. So it was very confronting to process all of that. But if I couldn't talk to her, who could?
So I want to read a passage from your book describing your state of mind on the night you danced for the last time, which was in Houston. Quote, "The thought that this would be my last dance kept repeating in my head. There would be no more comebacks after this. Everything felt surreal. All the years of passion, love, dedication, and hard work towards perfection would end here. The makeup, my point shoes, my costumes had me choking with emotion. How I wished it was just a bad dream." I want you to share with the audience your last moments of dancing that night, and I'll start you off. "My heart was bursting with joy as I walked onto the Houston stage. As the Sugar Plum Pas de Deux music sounded, I blocked all thoughts and just let the music flow through my body. Can you describe the closing arabesques and what passed through your mind in your last minutes on stage, soaking up the audience?"
Gosh, you try not to have thoughts, actually. But my relief that, because the sugar plum, they come on the stage like that, so Lee was on the other side. So that was the sad part, really, because we were a partnership. But I knew that, you know, coming on that, the first phrase, I knew that, you know, I would be looked after. So that was very special to have him to dance with my last... And it's something that we'd grown, you know, that we knew so well. And so you take the first hand and you take the first pose and you know if you have it in the bag or not. So, and at that point, I didn't think about this would be my last. It was only at the end with the curtain calls and the, you know, overwhelming applause. My mother had come, all the people that had supported me in Houston had come to see the show. And... But I think I was very resolute about the decision, and it was sad, and I was sad for quite some time. Not only was my Lee my partner in marriage, but we were a partner in the studio, so we had shared that for so long, and we wouldn't really be sharing that. So there was a lot of sadnesses, not so much on that night, but as time went on. But then Lee was very generous about keeping me connected in the studio, and that's when I started coaching. I started doing a little bit of coaching for him, and that's how my teaching career kind of came. Well, as if he'd shut me out of that, then I would have felt completely cut off from the ballet, and that would have been... I was cut off enough. So I think it wasn't really that night. It was the continuous sadness of not being up there. But then I...
Your focus just shifted and shifted and shifted.
I put those here. I was like a perfectionist with a deaf daughter.
We'll come to that in a minute. Describe the period from when you first discovered Sophie was profoundly deaf, so that's 18 months, to when she received a cochlear implant at 4, how slow her progress was in learning words and being able to speak them, and how much time and effort you were putting in each day.
Well, it was like a ballet day. As soon as I got up, I put those hearing aids on and I talked all day. I never stopped. Sometimes she'd go like that. And she had like 100 receptive words by the time she was 4. And it was sort of okay in a way. It was just me, but I knew that I had to release her to somehow go to kindergarten or school or socialise with others. And I would watch her like a hawk when she was with other children, and I knew she wasn't hearing them, so there was no way she could ever leave me.
And at the core of all this was your determination that Sophie would have her chance to be a participating part in a hearing world.
Yeah, independence, complete. I had to give her the opportunity to have independence, and that was the road that I believed that would give her independence. And so there wasn't a lot of research out on the implant. In fact, it was fairly frowned upon at that stage, and they just started doing it in 2-year-olds, and there was no real research out. And, you know, the therapist that I was with said, don't do it. But the surgeon said, I can give you hearing. And when he said, because the hearing aids, you know, she could detect sound at like 60 decibels, and we can detect sound at 0 to 10. So I understood. And when the surgeon said to me, I can give you hearing, and I was like, oh, well, if you give me hearing, I can give her language. So I really understood. People don't quite understand that. They think you just get an implant and it's all hunky-dory. Mm. It's not. Hearing is completely different to language. But I understood that because I'd been working on language for 2 years, and I thought, if I can have that channel, I can make that work. And
can you remember when you actually saw for the first time how it was going to work? When you saw her, I think she had her back to you.
Yeah, she had her back to me. And when she had hearing aids, I used to sing Rain, Rain, Go Away, Come Another Day. And she was turning her back and she went, Rain, Rain, Go Away. And she repeated the kung, you know, not in good English. Yeah. And I was like, that's it. She can do it. And from that moment, it gave me a sense of relief. And she started babbling and, you know, like no one else could understand her except for her brother, who seemed to always be able to understand her.
So you there were various milestones, and what you weren't realising, though, and you've written with great candour about this, what you didn't realise through a lot of that time was that Sophie was going through some dark times, and that she was going through struggles that you weren't really able to see. And you talk about the conflict that arose between you and Sophie over her revelations as a young adult to that effect, that her struggles in learning to speak were deeper and more painful than you understood. And that she started to push back against your ambition for her to be a full participant in the hearing world. I know you resolved the conflict, but can you briefly encapsulate what the issues were around that, around Sophie's conflict,
yeah,
if you like? Because I suspect many people would have made the same assumptions you did in their desire to help a profoundly deaf child.
Well, we always knew that Sophie's biggest issue was not going to be able to, not communicating, but it was socialising, because even with implants, if the sound comes from over here, she doesn't know it's come from over there, and she would have missed the sound. So as time went on, the choice was socialising her in an environment where she couldn't really hear perfectly. So there was always going to be massive issues, and everything around is she's surrounded by noise all the time, so she's certainly going to miss things, and she had to wear an FM, so she was different at school. And I had actually offered for her to learn to sign, but she had not taken that opportunity, but I didn't push it. She was very academic, and so she sort of put herself in the studies, and was sad about her social. It was difficult. It was difficult for us to watch, but part and parcel of being a deaf person and learning to speak is just, there's no way you can get away from that situation. There's no way you can help that situation. It's painful because it's not the norm.
Yeah, so and that period in Melbourne when and you'd moved up here, but she stayed in Melbourne.
I think against a tiger mom like Mary, growing up, it was...
Tread carefully, Lee.
It was, she did not have much a choice.
Yeah.
Because Mary's sacrifice have allowed me to continue my dance career, I could not believe that what dedication, love she poured into Sophie throughout these years. Every waking minute of Sophie's life, Mary's there talking to her. But, you know, that's why she's actually very successful today. But to really, for her to go through that kind of rebel stage, I think it's part to do with the delayed adolescence period.
Mm.
Just even for normal, child growing up, you go through that period. Mm. Anyway, for her it's much delayed because of language delay, everything else. So that was very difficult. And particularly it happened during the time when we moved over here, she was still left behind in Melbourne.
Yeah.
So that whole period was very disruptive for her.
And but it was her search for her identity, and she was both deaf and hearing, and she couldn't find, she was both.
Which she didn't know which world she belonged to, really.
And
there was a certain comfort in the deaf world, wasn't there?
Well, it was easy for her. I mean, she learned to sign fluently within 2 years. I mean, it took 15 years to teach her to speak? It took her 2 years to learn fluent sign.
So but she just... said to you, when you had one of your soul-searching conversations one night, I think it was in Brisbane, she said to you both,
Why
haven't you learnt Auslan? Why haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, really, I suppose we didn't really. Well, we could have made the opportunity, but until she really learnt to sign, we could have done it as a family. But we just, because she could speak, and until we had that moment, we didn't really. think about it too much until during COVID. We said, Soph, we will. Actually, Lee said, it's never too late. So we learnt, you know.
Right. And how is she now with all of what we've been talking about? How is she in terms of those two worlds and how she lives her life?
She lives in both, and I think she shows great leadership in both. And now the children, a lot of children are being implanted and they're both hearing and sign, and she would say definitely do both. Mm. And why wouldn't you have the two languages? And so, yeah, she would encourage that. And I think, I mean, I don't think there's been any research on it, but I think if babies are taught to sign early, they're probably their language acquisition, even hearing children, is probably faster.
Right.
Because they learn those signs very quickly, quicker than language.
Right, OK.
So, yeah.
I think if we were to live our lives again, I think we would definitely would have learned to sign sooner, much sooner. Would have, in hindsight, would have helped her a lot.
But in a way, you were all kind of guinea pigs, really, weren't you? Because the cochlear, at the time you embraced it, the cochlear was really still quite new.
No, but also they said, no, you can't, because it's different. This language, that language, eye language, is different to that.
Hearing, yeah.
Completely different. They're two different languages.
So we were told by somebody said to us, it's like a lazy eye syndrome.
Yeah.
If you don't cover up the good eye, you can never train that lazy eye. Yeah. So if she kept on signing, she may never develop
because
the hearing.
The signing was easy for her, while this was difficult.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Now, Lee, I know that you were born in the middle of China's great famine that killed 30 million people and earned Mao his greatest notoriety, I think. You've made plain how much you valued Western freedom since your defection. And China has gone through many stages since then. How much of China still lives in you today?
I think deep inside of me, obviously, I'm so grateful all the time, always, about the opportunities the Western world have given me such an incredible life and journey and career. But there's still a big part of me is still very Chinese. The values and, you know, the values my parents instilled in me. And I would forever be grateful because you know, even though life was tough when I grew up, even though I went through turmoils throughout my career, you know, teenager years and now, but really as you know, a Chinese still value the wonderful side of the Chinese culture, and for being Chinese, there are certain, you know, secret values I still love and treasure. One thing, for example, respect for elderly, it is such a beautiful quality in a person, beautiful value to behold, and I still, you know, do that.
I'm just thinking as you're saying that. I don't know how closely you followed the recent Royal Commission into aged care here, but you've given those values, the respect for the elderly. You must have wondered sometimes what the comparison with what happens here with old people, with the way we treat them here.
My parents would have killed us if we didn't.
I'll ask you both. I mean, how do you see your art within the wider landscape of the arts in this country? Does ballet enjoy a privileged position, and should it?
Oh, I think it should be available to all. I mean, and we do have, you know, community programs that we go out. Did you know that in Queensland there's 4,000 ballet schools?
Wow. Actually, it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, and it's just wonderful.
At a certain point, every parent with a young girl... Or the young girl comes home and says...
We've got four little boys on stage tonight. Yeah.
I think arts play such an
important part.
Magical part in our lives. Arts really transcend and life change, ballet change lives like other art forms.
And music.
If we take arts away, culture and art away from our daily lives, our life will be truly boring. we will miss the colour.
So how do you see the importance of the arts to a nation? And what do you think of the state of our arts and what that says about Australia?
I think it's vitally important. Arts is so important to the quality, enjoyment, happiness, cohesion of our society. And I really hope that we see great value in supporting, fostering arts in general. And I think we can, as a nation, we can invest a lot more into arts.
So right now, what does the state of the arts tell you about this nation, about the soul of the nation? We've seen the arts go through a terrible time with COVID. Certainly not always feeling supported. In fact, in many cases, people in the most desperate straits.
I think they need to help us more and encourage more and keep it in schools and have it as part of education.
I think what our politicians or society in general need to realise, arts not only in the actual physical dollar GDP output, which is occupying much higher percentage of the GDP output given back to the community through cultural tourism or, really the bums on seats in the theatres, restaurants, hotels, transportation, etc. The point I want to make is the actual dollar investment into the sector is much lower than what the contribution arts actually make into the economy. Mm-hmm. That's number one point. Number two is the intangible values. As I said earlier, the uplifting spirits and the happiness and cohesion bring people together. Those are, you can't put a dollar amount in on it. And those are truly reflect how well our society functioning, intellectual wealth we create, collectively through arts. That's the part is not being valued.
Yes. Lee, I know you arrived in Brisbane with big ambitions for Queensland Ballet. What was at the heart of those ambitions, and to what extent have you realised them?
That was nearly 10 years ago. I was approached by this headhunter looking for the new artist director after Francois, my predecessor, announced his retirement. And actually, I had an interesting conversation with the headhunter while I was a stockbroker at the time. Towards the end of the day, I was tired, and he asked me some questions. And he asked me at the end, asked for my thoughts about what that director should be. And I was very honest with him. At the end, he said, Lee, would you be interested in the job? I said, no, absolutely not. And then I went home that night. I said to Mary, I had this strange conversation. And then I said to Mary, I didn't even know who gave him my mobile number. And Mary said, I did.
Another rocky connection.
So then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, really our passion for ballet never left us, never left me, even though I went to stockbroker and did very well.
But I hope you weren't too creative as a stockbroker.
I wouldn't dare. The bottom line was that ballet has given us so much in our lives, have changed our lives, enriched our lives. And the question Mary posed to me was, wouldn't it be wonderful to give something back to that art form that has given us so much? And so I thought Queensland Ballet, even though it was very weak and small 10 years ago, I thought this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to transform it to a world-class company, which I think we're there at a world-class today.
Oh, I think that's a reasonable note to end on. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
For
Thank
participating you. In the conversation.
You've been listening to A Better Future for All, in conversation with Kerry O'Brien from Griffith University. Produced by Eddie Nalwafer and edited by Michael Adams and Andrew Thompson. Visit betterfuture.griffith.edu.au to keep up to date with our upcoming events or catch up on our past events on demand.